This is Free Thought Radio with your hosts, Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky.
Are you happy heretics? I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and welcome to Free Thought Radio.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist. And this show is produced by the Freedom From Religion Foundation, a national organization that works to keep state and church separate and to educate the public about the views of non-believers.
Our guest today, whom we'll talk with on the second half of our program, will be James Kors. Jim Kors is the newest officer of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Jim Kors is professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and we'll talk with him about evolution and Darwin, and also about why he thinks freedom from religion is so important.
And in a few minutes, something completely different, as Monty Python would say, we're going to air a clip of opening remarks from a recent debate by my esteemed co-host, Dan Barker. And when was this debate, Dan?
November of last year, 2009.
And where?
In San Marcos, Texas, just north of San Antonio at Texas State.
And whom did you debate?
I debated a guy named Kevin Colley, and the topic was, can we be good without God?
And of course, that's probably one of the greatest myths that we freethinkers face. It's the biggest slander, really, this idea that you can't be good unless you believe in a God, or that if you're an atheist, you must be immoral, and if you're a religionist, you are automatically a good person. And so, Dan, you did this debate as a Christian evangelist of 17 years.
And 19 years, actually.
19 years, and now you've been an atheist for how many years?
Oh, for 25 years.
So stay tuned. We're going to hear about How to Be Good Without God by Dan Barker, and we are also going to interview evolutionary biologist, Madison, Wisconsin's own Jim Kors. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio.
Daniel Dennett, author of Breaking the Spell, and you're listening to Free Thought Radio.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you.
This is Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker. Coming up, we're going to interview Jim Kors about his non-belief about evolution and Darwin. And Dan, as we promised, we're running your opening salvo in a recent debate. Do you want to introduce that?
Last November in San Marcos, Texas, I was at Texas State and I debated the topic, Can We Be Good Without God? With Kevin Colley. And what we're going to listen to right now is just an excerpt of my opening statement in that debate.
I was traveling to speak on the Phil Donahue show back in the late 80s. I think it was 1988, to speak about atheism on a national TV show. I was in the Detroit airport, standing in line to kind of get onto the flight, and there was another line over here next to me. I wasn't paying much attention, you know, there's a lot of people around, but some young couple there, and they had a little baby, and the husband had put the baby carrier on top of the stacked luggage about this high. And apparently the husband had wandered off, because out of the corner of my eye, I saw that little baby kick and turn, and I saw that carrier start tumbling off of the luggage. And without even thinking, I just made this large stride over to the left, and I caught the edge of that thing with my fingertips as it was tumbling through the air, and then kind of turned it around. And about a second later, the mother grabbed the other side of it. She would have been too late. And I looked at her and I said, that was scary. We both didn't want to let go for a while, you know. That was a pretty scary thing. And finally she took it, and you should have seen the look she gave her husband. getting into the plane, I saw they were going in. As soon as they went into the door, the mother turned around and gave me a look, like maybe she thought I was an angel or something. I don't know, some angel going to talk about atheism on the Phil Donahue show. What I did was not that special. I know Kevin would have done the same thing in the same situation. I know most of you would have done the same thing. Why do that? What was in that for me? I mean, I don't know those people. Did I go up to them and say, oh, by the way, I just saved your baby. I hope someday you pay me back. Reciprocal altruism. Did I tell that mother, oh, by the way, I'm glad I did this because now I can have a reward in heaven. Or I'm glad I was good to you because now there's less risk of me going to hell and being punished because I was a good person. Would that have satisfied? Would she have cared even about my motives? When I was standing there before that happened, was I thinking about Jesus and about the need for moral absolutes? Was I thinking about Muhammad or Joseph Smith or Buddha? Was I contemplating, you know, how can I be a good moral person? Was any of that going through my mind? No. The sight of my peripheral vision saw something and it just happened. Haven't you had those experiences in your life where you've just done something just because? And why is it just because? Well, I think a big part of ethics and morality and being a good person is that we come prepackaged as biological organisms. And let's face it, everybody in this room is an animal. We're biological creatures and we live in a natural environment. And if there's a spiritual world, well, that's your opinion. But basically, we live our lives in the real world where things really matter. I wasn't thinking about, should I be pleasing some creator father of mine and doing the thing that would give glory to this father. What happened was this instantaneous, instinctive thing. I mean, who wants to see a baby crash on the floor? I mean, really? Does that need any explanation? Before that thing happened, did I stop and say, wait a minute, let me weigh the relative merits of the consequences of my actions and see what would be better if that baby fell? No, let's see, there would be more harm in society. None of that happened. My biological animal that I am did that thing. Scientists now realize that that kind of empathy is not limited to the species. Other primates, especially chimpanzees, they will sacrifice, they will help, they will go out of their way, they will lick the wounds, they will... Elephants do a very similar thing too. Elephants have this emotive way of dealing with other members of their species. Dolphins and whales have this kind of same basic biological urge, not only within their own species. There's even examples of, there was a drowning old dog and a seal pushed it up into the land. Cross species helping each other. We are programmed by evolution to be good. There is no such thing as original sin. I used to preach it as a minister, but I now realize that we are all a mixture. Each one of us contains the potential for immense acts of violence. And if somebody's attacking my kids, you can bet I could be violent. Any one of you would be violent. That's the way we are. We come with this mixture. But notice this. When you see some horrible headline, some heinous deed that somebody did, you go, oh my goodness, how could someone do that? What's the first thing we think? That was so inhuman. Don't we assume that the human thing to do is to catch that baby, right? We assume that human nature has the potential for goodness, for preservation of ourselves, for the preservation of our species and of our loved ones and of the communities we live in, and by extension, the entire species, and even many of us, other species. Who's to say that dogs don't feel empathy and sorrow and shame and guilt? Of course, if that dog is being attacked, that very same little dog can be a very vicious animal. We all come with that to some degree or another. The reason to be good is because if you're not good, our survival as a species and therefore as individuals is compromised. Science is showing us more and more through research the evolutionary explanation for why we as a species don't have original sin, but we actually have original good built within us. Those of our ancestors who did not cooperate had a less chance of surviving and propagating their genes into the future than those who did cooperate. Millions of good Americans, and about a billion people on this planet do not believe in a God, and yet they are good people. There is no debate about the question, can you be good without God? That's not a debate. That's almost a prejudice. If you were to even suggest that we atheists and agnostics can't be good people, That would be like a discriminatory thing to say. Of course, just look at the lives of non-believers. Who is to say that Elizabeth E. Stanton was not a good person? She did not believe in a God. The woman who fought for 50 years of her life for women's rights, because she noticed that most of the oppression of women in her day was coming from the Bible. The Bible tells women to shut up and be quiet and learn from their husbands. The Bible denied them the right to even own their property or own their own children or even go to college. She was fighting this religious uptrend of women, and she devoted her whole life to that without believing in a God, but caring about humanity. Look at Margaret Sanger. Even people who try to demonize Margaret Sanger are using birth control. I bet most Christian women in this audience, don't raise your hands, I bet you have used birth control thanks to the efforts of the non-believing, atheistic Margaret Sanger, who cared about this world. She cared about real human beings who were suffering, who needed help in the real world. That's what good means. Good does not mean flattering daddy. Good does not mean following orders. Good does not mean that we are getting brownie points so that we can be judged someday by how moral we are. Good means actually making it in the real world. The Ochsner brothers in Baraboo, Wisconsin, were both atheists, both non-believers. They went down to New Orleans and they founded that famous Ochsner Clinic. You know, you sometimes hear, have atheists ever built hospitals? Well, of course they have. But the Ochsner brothers were smart enough not to put the words atheist hospital on top of their clinic. Because who would go to an atheist hospital? Of course atheists and agnostics build hospital and care about the sick. If you need any evidence of that, look at the Soviet Union, an officially atheistic country that built hundreds of hospitals. A friend of ours who just died this year, Dr. Watley in Alabama, founded a women's clinic. Another friend of mine, Dr. Gordon, when he retired, he founded a free clinic in the Philippines, hiking up and down the mountains there, helping people as an atheist because he cared about humanity. And he was working side by side with the Catholic doctors who were often charging the people while he was giving free treatment, and he didn't care. Nobody asked him what his views were. He was there to care. A friend of mine in Atlanta who marched shoulder to shoulder with the Baptists during the civil rights marches as an atheist and a non-believer, nobody cared what his views were. He was there because of the issues. So when we ask the question, how can you be good without God, what does the word good mean? I think the word good simply means less harm. What do we mean by being moral? What we mean is that we are trying to have a world that has less harm in it, less of a threat to our security, less of a threat to our well-being and survival. And the people who are good are the people who are acting in ways to lessen the harm. If you think good means something else, such as following the orders of daddy, then you don't have the first clue what morality means. Morality is something that is measured by how much actual harm is resulted. So if you have the time, I didn't have the time when that little baby was falling, but if you have the time and you're making a decision, you should weigh the relative merits of the consequence of these available options to you, look at them on balance, and attempt to pick the path that results in the least amount of harm in the world. And harm, by the way, is a physical thing, natural thing. It's not offending the ego of some father who needs to be praised and you're not praising him right by worshiping on the Sabbath or saying the right words. But if you are trying to act in ways that minimize and lessen harm in the world, you can see the results of it by actually looking at what happened in the real world. Believers in God do not have any better track record in morality and ethics than those who don't. Yes, every group has their saints and it also has their embarrassing sinners. Stalin was a horrible atheist. Hitler was a horrible Christian. Hitler believed in God. So yes, there are embarrassments on both sides, there are saints on both sides, but on balance, Christians and Jews and believers in God do not have any better track record. And when it comes to any measure of morality or well-being or happiness, Christians are not cutting it. They're not doing any better. We often hear Christians say that the Bible gives us absolute moral guidance. If we didn't have the Bible, we'd be all like ships without a rudder. We'd be floating. How do we know what's good unless Daddy tells us what's good? Well, if that's true, the Bible should be this beacon of morality, shouldn't it? And yet, you name any single issue. What are we struggling with in society right now? Gay marriage, stem cell research, what else?
Abortion rights.
Abortion rights, birth control, the war, doctor-assisted suicide. Yeah, a lot of these issues we're struggling with in society, right? We all have different points of view. The point here is that you will find devout, good, Bible-believing, church-going Christians, you will find them on both sides of those issues. You don't have a beacon in the Bible. You don't have a... What did Jesus say about homosexuality? Nothing. And yet you've seen those what would Jesus do things? If I was going to do what Jesus did, I would keep my mouth shut about homosexuality. He never say a thing about it. What did Jesus say about abortion? Nothing. The Bible itself is not a good absolute moral beacon for ethics and values because there's no agreement among believers. People say, well, all of these good values you're talking about as a humanist and an atheist. You know, we humanists and atheists, we want accountability and honesty and we want love and we want goodness. You know, we want all these things. And a Christian will tell me, well, that's Christianity because Christianity wants goodness and love. So you're just borrowing from Christianity. And I say, no, it's the other way around. Those are not Christian values. Those are human values. Christians are welcome to share those values with us. Other religions have them as well. The fact that they are shared by almost all the religions shows that they transcend the religion. They are better than the religion. Those values that Christianity or Islam have that differ from the common set of values that we all have, those values are not good values. On balance, Jesus and Christianity have not provided a positive moral guideline. If you are motivated to be good because of the promise of heaven, that shows how little you think of other people, doesn't it? If you are motivated to be good because of the threat of hell, that shows how little you think of yourself. What we humanists and atheists say, be good for goodness sake.
And we've been listening to a clip of my co-host, Dan Barker, from his recent You Can Be Good Without God debate at Texas State in San Marcos.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor for Free Thought Radio. We'll be back after this break to interview Jim Coors about why religion never took with him, and in this month of February, to talk with him, a professor of agronomy, about the importance of Darwin and evolution.
Hi, I'm Len Eisenberg from Ashland, Oregon. I'm on Free Thought Radio, and atheists are the nicest people.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio.
And we're very pleased to have in the studio with us here in Madison, Wisconsin, our guest today, James Coors. Jim has been a member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation for about 25 years. Yeah. For the past 24 years, he was professor in the Department of Agronomy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's now professor emeritus. His specialty is plant breeding and genetics, so his background is evolutionary biology. He's active in a number of scientific societies. He's used those platforms, as he puts it, to loudly and publicly decry the teaching of intelligent design in classrooms. And we're very happy that, as of last November, Jim Coors has now become one of the national officers of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and we're pleased to get this chance to talk with him directly. Welcome to Free Thought Radio, Jim.
Well, great. It's really nice to be here, Annie, Laurie, Dan. This is great.
So before we talk about the battle of science versus religion, I wondered if you wanted to talk a little bit about your own background, whether you were raised religion, your loss of faith story.
I don't have a loss of faith story. As I've mentioned to you previously, I think, you know, I never had any to begin with. I've come by my atheism, if you will, fairly easily, and it's been a pretty steady course from as long as I can remember.
You're lucky.
But were you raised in a religious family?
Well, I suppose so. You know, I think my family was Episcopalian, as I recall, which is
hardly religious at all.
Hardly religious at all. So yeah, it wasn't a big element.
So at what age did you realize you were an unbeliever?
I'm not sure again whether it was ever a realization or just sort of a gradual sort of appreciation of the fact that you know.
You life. Were never a believer in the first place.
I was
right?
never, yeah, and sort of, you know, what we have is what we've got, and that's fine with me, as it always has been.
Well, I envy that because I had to go through that struggle, you know, of being a true believer and having to undo all that, and you just get to sail through life. Just as a natural human being.
Well, your book is very inspirational, though, and I admire a great deal of what you went through and how you thought about things. And to some extent, I missed that in my own development.
No, you're lucky. Believe
yeah. Start at zero instead of a debt.
It's been easy. So.
And did you grow up in Colorado, or where are
yes.
you from?
Yes, I was born in Denver, Colorado. Right.
And so now you are, you're very young still, but you are a professor emeritus of agronomy. And before we talk about the evolution thing, I have to tell you, I'm not sure what agronomy is.
Well, I don't think most people are.
Agronomy.
Agronomy. I just think of it as a study of agriculture. And so it could be crops, soils, anything having to do, and I'm a, you know, geneticist plant breeder, so that's part of it too. So
evolution has to figure really largely into this, but I think the typical person wouldn't think of a professor of agronomy as being an ardent evolutionist.
Well, yeah, and I think that's right. I'm really fortunate to actually be a geneticist plant breeder, because if you actually look at what inspired Darwin, the first mm-hmm. chapter of The Origin of Species, of species, and it was really the plant breeders, the animal breeders, that really got him going. And provide a lot of the evidence for what he knew to be the case, but he really needed demonstration of a large amount of genetic variation and that you could work on that and change things over time.
So where did your interest in science, when did that begin? And were you early a fan of Darwin, or did that come with your education?
I think it came with my education. As a mathematician, or at least I majored in math when I was in college. But I did come from a somewhat of a farm background and enjoyed working with animals and plants and roaming around and just enjoying nature. I always have.
You're right about Darwin. I read that he, forget the exact words, but he called botany a kind of a flank attack against the creationists. Because if you're talking about humans and primates, it strikes close to home. But when you talk about the evolution of plants, that's sort of a softer, easier way. In fact, most farmers accept the fact of evolution, don't they?
Yes, I think they do, because they're using improved varieties that change every year. For example, this year I think we have the highest corn yields, highest soybean yields we've ever had in this country, three times what was the case back in 1930. That's a genetic improvement over a relatively short period of time.
And that's evolution.
And that's evolution. It's just directed by man. It's pretty obvious that things can change. And so, as you say, it's a flank attack. Hmm. Well, yeah, it's a pretty effective one.
Now, as a professor, and I know you've just retired, what is your assessment of the students you're seeing and their understanding of evolution and science, and where do we need to improve, and is this a problem even in your field?
Yeah, it's a huge problem. and that's really... I found it more recently, I've been very upset by what I'm seeing. You know, at UW-Madison, we're in a cocoon, an academic cocoon. Mm-hmm. And when I stepped out of that, you realize how bad the situation is, especially in high schools. As you move around the country, the South, evolution just, it isn't even mentioned.
It's not being taught.
It's not being taught.
Well, so when you were getting students, did a lot of them have to make up for things when they got to college? Were you finding that they were uneducated at the
there's a
secondary
certain,
level?
A certain level of that. I think people who tend to go into graduate school mm-hmm. sort of they have to have the basics or they can't get in the first place. And that's not the people I'm upset with, or I'm not upset with them. I'm just upset with the system that creates uneducated people. The uneducated people about evolution are those who sort of go through high school and then just go out into the world, or maybe go on to college in different fields other than something involving biology, and end up sort of isolated from evolution.
Now, you belong to some of these scientific societies, and you've told us that you really like to push against things like intelligent design. What are some of those societies, and I mean, are you having, do you feel that most scientists tend to be more timid? They don't speak out enough? Are you trying to make up for that? I mean,
yeah, I think, you know, my awakening in this really came in about 2005, and this was when the intelligent design thing was happening, the Dover trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the president at that time, President Bush, actually said something like, teach the controversy in a major speech.
Yeah.
When that happened, I was president of the Crop Science Society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, crop science, people don't think of that as, mm-hmm. you know, a genetics, but it is because I'm a plant breeder. So we wrote a statement challenging Bush in that. And we got two other societies to join us. And it caused an uproar. And within our, you know, the group of people that we touch with our statements. And that's when it became aware, and when I became aware, that a lot of people I thought were accepting of evolution had no understanding of what they were dealing with and really were antagonistic.
So you mean even within the scientific societies that you were working with, there was controversy because of these statements?
Yes.
Well, that is
really...
And
that was very upsetting to me.
So what's the remedy?
The remedy is going down to the lowest levels of education, mm-hmm. of schooling that you can get to, and start getting these concepts in there, getting people to appreciate biology, getting them to appreciate the natural world.
Is there like a class, like an introductory class in evolution? I mean, doesn't someone who comes to one of your classes, shouldn't they have already gone through a prerequisite that kind of lays out the basics?
Well, I think in most good schools, there's something about that in high school or junior high school. I don't think people talk about it prior to that. But, you know, a lot of teachers were emailing me during this period and saying, don't even bring up this subject. If I bring up the subject of evolution, if I even mention the word, we're going to be derailed from 2 weeks while parents start complaining and I've got to explain what I'm doing. I don't want to deal with that. I've got other things I want to teach.
In high school level.
In high school.
So you're not even supposed to say the E word.
You're not even supposed to say the E word.
Like, you're supposed to say change over time or use a euphemism or...
change over time, you know, that's a euphemism. People recognize that, and they say, oh, we don't really want to get into that either.
Like, we can talk about falling bodies, but don't use the word gravity. Don't use the G word, you know. It's just a theory.
Well, it's so interesting because this change over time thing goes way back to way before Darwin, when change over time was it. You didn't even suggest there was change over time because why should there be? I mean, God created everything, and it was perfect. And so if there was change, that meant there was something wrong with what was there before. And so, you know, I don't think that attitude has changed very much in a large number of people.
But at the college level and in a lot of the classes you taught, is there even an opportunity to talk about these general principles? Aren't you talking about specific agronomy things in your classes?
Right. Yeah, no, and that's what I try to encourage my colleagues now is to start getting into this whole issue of evolution, change over time, mechanisms, because we have so many tools now that really show how this happens. The whole molecular genetics, evolutionary biology, it's just spectacular. And there's nothing that we have found in the last 150 years from the origin that at all says that there's anything wrong with the evolutionary theory that Darwin put forward.
Well, and it's the cornerstone of biology. It would be the cornerstone of agronomy.
I think it's the cornerstone of a good, healthy outlook on life. It really says to me what we're all
reality.
About on this planet. And to deny that to people and put in place something that's, frankly, in many cases, a fairy tale is really damaging.
Well, because it's the Bible.
I agree. I'm Annie Laurie Geller with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. In studio with us today, evolutionary biologist and nearly lifelong non-believer Jim Kors, and we'll be right back.
Hi, my name is Liz from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and I'm on Free Thought Radio.
Protect the First Amendment. It protects you.
I'm Annie Laurie Geller with Dan Barker for Free Thought Radio. We're talking with James Kors in studio, Professor Emeritus of Agronomy at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and an officer of the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
And Jim, you work, you taught in agronomy, in plants, in biology, in genetics, right? And that's pretty much what Darwin was doing for the last half of his life. He spent a lot of time working with plants and discovering a lot of things about how plants breed and how they can be bred and changed and all that. So Darwin plays a lot in your thinking and the way you were teaching in your classes.
Yes, he does, and mainly as an inspiration. We think about this theory of evolution by means of natural selection, and we have to. This is an amazing thing that he came up with, given the fact he had no knowledge of anything genetic. The theory of Mendel was not even known. The theory of genetics wasn't even known. So the idea that there was anything heritable about the behavior or stature of a plant or an animal was actually quite interesting.
But I mean, he had a rough idea. There had to be some mechanism.
He had a rough idea that there was a resemblance among relatives, and that so there was, but they did not know how this was happening.
Because it had to be discrete, as far as he knew, right?
Yeah, somewhat. But it was a key to his, you know, what Darwin really recognized was the mechanism of evolution. People were sort of proposing that things changed. Scientists kept quiet about it because they didn't want to get into trouble. But what Darwin did, he said, this is the mechanism. It's natural selection. And boom, as soon as he said that, and his argument was so logical that, and he had all the evidence, he took 20 years to sort of accumulate the evidence before he actually published. It was such a powerful argument that he just suddenly, this whole thing just opened wide up. And there's a couple things. Number one, his intuition. Two, his logic, and also his doggedness in preparing the evidence for public.
And afterwards, a lot of people said, "I could have thought of that." Yeah,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Well, they didn't.
But they didn't. It was a relatively simple statement. I mean, it's not relatively simple. It's a very simple statement.
Yeah.
But it was so logical, and people did. They just turned around and said, "Why hadn't I ever thought about that?"
Yeah.
And that's another sort of piece of inspiration. You have to sort of think outside the box, and then suddenly these relatively simple breakthroughs can happen to you. And he did it. The other thing, of course, is he's a very quiet, gentle man, and his personality was such that people believed him when he said things. He wasn't trying to advance some personal cause or agenda. And he was a gentleman. He didn't even show up for the reading of his paper with Wallace in 1858 at the Linnaean Society when this whole idea came out. He didn't show up.
He was very retiring.
Very retiring, yes.
Now, you were saying during the break, of course, that February we're marking the 200 and what is it?
201st.
Anniversary of Darwin's birth.
On February 12th, along with Abraham Lincoln.
That's right. Two great giants.
Two great giants, and they actually had sort of similar feelings about all things religious.
This is true.
Yeah.
So. And a lot of people don't know that.
No.
So Darwin was really, really smart. What's wrong with our country that 50% or more of adult Americans reject evolution?
Everybody's trying to figure that one out.
I mean, religion seems to be the answer.
Religion is the answer, but again, something's happened over the last 20 years that has brought this back as a festering problem that we kind of really weren't dealing. I mean, it wasn't that big of a problem. It's always been a problem from the Scopes trial on, mm-hmm. even before that, but it's much worse now. And it's a sad state of education that's really causing it, I think.
It's the Bible, isn't it?
Well,
respect for the Bible.
Respect for the Bible, and actually, just our reticence to challenge things religious. And again, that's one of the things I'm trying to sort of change in myself. Is I'm never going to say, "Well, that person has a religious viewpoint. Hands off. It's doing too much damage."
Because you tend to be a little bit retiring yourself, like Darwin, don't you?
Yeah, but as I get older, I have less to lose, and so.
Now, from a perspective of a university professor, and you must have gone to a lot of national and international conferences, I mean, this is really holding our country back. It has great potential to harm our nation, this kind of rejection of evolution and repression of
science.
We're
talking about understanding the natural world. And if 50% of our students, and I've just brought that figure up as just some guess, is not even getting any picture of that. It's very depressing and very damaging.
I remember when I was a believer, I was nominally opposed to evolution, but I actually didn't know what I was opposed to. I had this weird idea that it was some kind of a force, you know, some weird, I didn't know what it was. And later, as I started waking up and I read what evolution actually is, I went, wow, that's cool. Oh, so that's what it is. It's not that hard to get, but it was just a little bit of a mind shift to go, oh, the impersonal nature of it. It was amazing.
Well, I'm going to turn that question right back to you when you said that's cool. What is it that you found that was that cool about it?
To see this machine, it's not really a machine, but to see natural selection as a sieve,
right,
as a filter, and that those of us who survived come from ancestors who survived, and there are all these billions of ghosts who didn't survive, who might have wanted to be here that aren't, and natural selection then is like a, it's kind of like a template or like one of those stencils that only allows us to get through because of the natural environment.
Well, we've run out of time. Thank you so much, Jim Kors, for joining us, for joining the Foundation Executive Council.
And we also want to thank, as always, our excellent engineer and producer, Brian Turani. The show is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. Our announcer is Buzz Kemper. Go to ffrf.org/radio for archives and podcast of this show.
Ask for more information at ffrf.org. Phone 1-800-335-4021. Join the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Ask for a sample of our newspaper, Free Thought Today. Check us out at our website. Again, 1-800-335-4021. We invite you to tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.